You prepare it and insisted on tasting it themselves. They do not trust you? Of course not. My father gave his word that I would do as I was told, but everyone knows how I feel about Arsinoe. He clears his throat. But regardless, I don't want you eating anything except what I prepare. Do you understand? Why not? Because I've been assured that if you die on my watch, Ro will saw off my head and send it back to my father on a barge. Mirabella laughs. We send many grisly things back on barges, it seems. Yes. Billy arches his brow. Joseph told me what Bree said to him before he sailed. The cloth overlay of Billy's cart clucks, and a brown chicken pokes her head out from under the covering, stepping out of the basket she was riding in. There is a chicken in your cart. I know, Billy snaps, and slaps his napkin across his lap. Why is there a chicken in your cart? Because this was supposed to be chicken stew, he says. I've been hand-feeding this bird for days to be sure it was not poisoned before the fact, and now... He pours Mirabella some water and drinks from her cup. The hen clucks, and Billy tosses down a chunk of bread. Now her name is Harriet, he says quietly. Mirabella laughs. No doubt you think I've been spending too much time with lowly naturalists, he says. I would never say that. The naturalists are the island's lifeblood. They feed us. They ensure good hunts. A very queenly answer, one you have been groomed to say. You think because I was raised for the crown, I do not know how to think for myself. Billy shrugs. He takes a spoonful of greasy stew and swallows it down hard before turning to the bread. I've known girls like you before. Not queens, of course, but very rich, very spoiled girls who have grown up hearing nothing but praise, nothing but talk of their family's important place in the world. And I never liked any of them more than just to look at. Mirabella takes a bite of pork. It is terrible. If all she has to eat between now and the crowning is food that Billy has cooked, she will be nearly as thin as Katarine. Those are unkind words, she says. Your family is not poor, or you would not be here. True enough, or it would be, were my father not reminding me daily that he will take it all, that he will give it away if I don't earn it. How must you earn it? She asks. By accomplishing whatever benchmark gets into his head that day. Being accepted into the right school, impressing the governor, winning a cricket match, becoming king consort of a secret, mystical island. But you ran away from the island, Mirabella says, with Arsinoe. You would give up your fortune for her? Billy chuckles around a mouthful of bread. Don't be ridiculous. I always planned on coming back. Mirabella lowers her head and smiles. His words say one thing, but the truth lies in the color that rises to his cheeks. Besides, he says, I hardly believe he means it anymore. The same threat used daily loses its shine, you know. Why are you smiling? No reason. She stabs a piece of potato with her fork and drops it into the grass for the chicken. It is tragic what has happened to Arsinoe's suitors in Wolf Spring, but some part of you must be glad that they are not there with her anymore. Glad is not the word I would use when discussing it. Those lads are dead, and Katarine is insane. It could have just as easily been me who was killed. I don't know whether you're truly the chosen queen, like everyone around here seems to believe. But for Fenburn's sake, you had best hope that it's not Katarine. She'll be ruinous. The queen who is crowned is the queen who was meant to be. Billy sighs. My God, isn't it exhausting to parrot back temple rhetoric? Do you ever think for yourself? I thought for myself when I saved Arsinoe, Mirabella says sharply. And the clouds overhead darken. At Innisfool, when they tried to cut her to pieces. And 2 days later, she sent a bear after me. So do not tell me she would be better for the island. She is just as heartless as Katarine. He stabs at a chunk of pork, like he wishes it was Mirabella's eye. "She didn't send that bear after you, you great idiot," he says. "What?" "Nothing. Never mind." "No, what did you mean by that? Of course she sent it." Mirabella glances at the priestesses near the house and lowers her voice. "Who else could control her familiar?" "Who else do you think?" Billy asks, his voice equally low. "Another strong naturalist, perhaps? One who would have just as much motivation to hurt you after you stole the boy she loved? Perhaps someone who Arsinoe would always lie for?" Billy adds. But when Mirabella opens her mouth, he stops her. "Don't say her name out loud. I shouldn't have told you Arsinoe's going to kill me." "Then," Mirabella says, as Billy goes back to prodding at his horrible meal, "Arsinoe never meant to hurt me?" "No, she didn't. Arsinoe grew up believing that she would die. She just didn't count on having so much to live for. Jules and Joseph and the Malones?" He smiles slightly. "Me? But what good is knowing any of this? This is the way of the island, isn't it? The natural order. So what does it change?" Mirabella's fingers dig into her napkin. She wants to scream or cry, but if she does, the priestesses will come running. "I almost killed her that day in the road," she whispers. "Why did she let me do that?" "Maybe because she knew you had to. Maybe she wanted to make it easier on you." Mirabella's eyes fill with tears, and Billy quickly wipes his mouth. He scoops strawberry tart onto his fork and holds it out. "Here," he says. "You must try this." As she takes the bite, he uses his thumb to discreetly wipe the tear that falls down her cheek. "I'm sorry," he says softly. "I suppose I haven't even tried to consider your point of view. It was thoughtless of me." "It is all right," Mirabella says. "Does she know that you love her?" Billy raises his eyebrows. "Why would she when I didn't? It wasn't like I read in books. A thunderclap, eyes meeting, tortured glances. With Arsinoe, it was more like having cold water poured down your back and learning to enjoy it." "And does she love you?" "I don't know. I think she might." He smiles. "I hope she does." "I hope so, too." Another tear slides down her cheek, and Billy darts forward to discreetly hide it. "It is all right," she says. "They will think I am only crying because of how terrible this strawberry tart is." Billy sets down his fork, insulted. Then they both begin to laugh. Wolf Spring. They put the suitors in long wooden boxes to sail them home, as is the mainland tradition. The boxes seem small and are so still that Arsinoe's throat squeezes shut. She knew Tommy and Michael so briefly. Two boys who thought they might be king, who perhaps thought it was all just a great game. The Black Council sent the poisoners Lucian Aaron and Lucian Marlowe to examine the bodies, hoping to find evidence that they did not die from poison. But of course they had.
"Let them start as many rumors as they want," Joseph says. "Everyone will know now that they've lost control of their queen."
He slips one arm about Jules's waist and the other around Arsinoe's, but she slides out of it. "She killed those boys, not Katarine. She was careless, and she killed them." Arsinoe steps closer to the edge of the dock and watches as the ship bearing Tommy's and Michael's bodies casts off into the cove.
"I can't breathe, Jules," she says and gulps air.
She feels Camden press warm fur against her legs, and then Jules is there to hold her up.
"You were right. I shouldn't have played with it. I don't know how to be careful."
"Hush, Arsinoe," Jules whispers. "There are too many people gathered on the dock. Too many ears." Arsinoe waits until the boat is out of sight and turns back toward shore, her feet hammering the wooden planks. The faster she gets back to the Malone house, the faster this day will be over.
Queen Arsinoe,
someone shouts as she crosses the docks toward the hill road.
Where is your bear?
Well, he's not in my pocket, she snaps without pausing. So he must be in the woods.
Rolandth. The letter from Natalia is addressed to the High Priestess and not the Queen, but Ro insists that it be opened by gloved novices in a windless room. She will not allow Luca to touch it before it is thoroughly examined.
You are being ridiculous, Luca says. The priestesses have been with the letter for most of the morning, and none of them have fallen ill with so much as a paper cut. There is nothing to be gained by poisoning me.
Luca paces across her room indignantly.
And if there were, Natalia would have done it by now. Goddess knows she has had many chances.
She goes to her eastern window and throws the shutters open for the breeze. As far north as it is, Roland does not get terribly hot. But in summer, her rooms in the temple can still feel stifling. Her old quarters in the capital were much better. When her legs were young, she walked off tension on the many stairs of the east tower of the Volroy. She sighs. She is so old. If Mirabella is crowned and they return to Indrid Down, she will have to be carried up and down in a litter. Finally, her chamber door opens and Ro enters with the letter in hand. From the look on her face, Luca knows that she has ignored the order not to read it.
Well, Luca asks,
what does it say?
She snatches the letter angrily, but Ro does not flinch. Ro never flinches. Her toughness is as much a comfort as it is annoying.
See for yourself, Ro says.
Luca's eyes skim over it so greedily the first time that she barely comprehends a word and must start again. It opens with only her name, Luca, as if she and Natalia are old friends. No High Priestess, no other greeting. The corner of Luca's mouth twists upward.
She wants to push the queens together for the high festivals, with Midsummer in Wolf Spring and the Reaping Moon to be held here.
They are plotting something, Rose says.
Luca purses her lips and reads the letter again. It is short, and for Natalia, almost conversational.
Luca reads aloud. Surely you would welcome the chance for your Mirabella to make good on her promises.
She puts the letter down and scoffs.
Surely.
She fears a stalemate. She does not want the ascension to end with the queens locked in the tower, says Ro. She knows that poisoners do not fare well there.
Mirabella may not either, if Arsinoe is still alive with her great brown bear.
Luca taps her chin. You know that by sending this letter she is lulling you with courtesy. She knows that we could stop it if we chose.
The Black Council does not have the final word when it comes to the high festivals.
Luca kicks at embroidered pillows that have fallen onto the floor.
I think we should do it, she says. Mirabella is strong, and whatever action the Aarons have planned to take, at least it will not come as a surprise.
We will take care, Ro says. But with the three queens face to face, I like our chances. She is strong, like you said.
Ro's eyes sparkle. Despite her cautious words, she craves bloodshed. Luca lowers her head and asks the goddess for guidance. But the only answer that hums into her bones is the one she has known all along. That if the crown is meant to be Mirabella's, then she will rise up and take it.
Luca, Ro asks, always impatient, shall we begin preparations for an envoy to Wolf Spring?
Luca takes a breath.
Do it. Get started right away. I am going to take some air.
Ro nods, and Luca leaves to wander down the steps and through the temple, keeping clear of the gathered worshippers who flock to the altar daily. As she passes one of the lower storerooms, she reaches out to close a door that is slightly ajar, and glimpses someone inside. It is the suitor, Billy Chatworth,
searching through the temple stores with a large brown chicken perched beside him on a few crates of dresses.
High Priestess, he says when he sees her and bends a shallow bow. I was after some fruit to attempt a pie with.
To add to your chicken? She asks and chuckles. You do not need to do all of this. The priestesses will prepare meals for you.
And leave me with so little to do? Besides, I'm not in the habit of having my life in anyone's hands but my own.
Luca nods. He is a handsome lad, with sandy hair and an easy smile. And despite his devotion to Queen Arsinoe, Luca has come to like him. She does not trust him, and priestesses watch his every move. But to Luca, his fondness for Arsinoe is only evidence of a good heart. Once she is dead, he will learn to love Mirabella in the same way.
Will you take a walk with me, Billy? She asks. These old legs need to stretch.
Of course, High Priestess.
He takes her arm and they go out through the courtyard and past the vegetable gardens toward the roses. It is a fine day. A light, cool breeze races toward the basalt cliffs of Shannon's Blackway, and pink and white roses bounce with bees from the apiary.
How are you and Mirabella getting along? She asks.
Well enough, he says,
but there is more fondness in his voice now than when she asked a few weeks ago.
She's growing thin on my cooking, but I am getting better, I promise.
Well, you cannot get any worse. She has told me about your stews.
They pass Elizabeth, and she waves, with netting around her face from gathering honey.
Could I get a measure of that? Billy asks.
I will bring some to the house later, Elizabeth calls. And some grain, for your chicken.
Luca turns to look behind them. She had not noticed that the brown hen was following from the storeroom.
You have found a familiar, it seems, Luca says. Will you bring her back to Wolf Spring when you go?
I suppose I will. But who knows when that may be?
Sooner than you think.
Luca stops and turns to face him.
Have you heard much of the Midsummer Festival?
The next High Festival, he says.
I have heard Sarah and the priestesses discussing preparations.
Here in Rolinth, the elementals sacrifice a small barge of vegetables and rabbit meat. They set it alight in the river and push it out to sea.
Luca turns south, toward the city, remembering all the past festivals she has presided over. Sometimes Mirabella would put on beautiful displays of water spouts. Luca had felt so close to the goddess in those moments. She knew then that she was precisely where she was meant to be, doing precisely what she was meant to do.
In Wolf Spring, she goes on, they set lanterns on their boats and take to the harbor at twilight. They throw grain into the water to feed the fish. It is more rustic, perhaps, but quite lovely. I went there for the festival many times as a girl.
She sighs.
It will be nice to see it again.
Why would you go to the Wolf Spring Festival?
Billy asks suspiciously.
We will all go. You and I, and Mirabella and the Westwoods, the Black Council and Queen Catherine. I am about to send word to Indrid Down that the Queens will spend the remaining high festivals together. Midsummer in Wolf Spring, and the Reaping Moon here in Rolinth.
You're putting them together, so that one will die.
Yes, she says. That is the way things work in an ascension year.
Greavesdrake Manor. Nicholas has targets set on the long, level swath of grass past the rear courtyard. He knocks an arrow and fires it near the center of the target, just to the left of the one he fired before that.
Beautifully done, Catherine says, and claps.
Nicholas sets down his bow and lets her take her turn. To his credit, the smile on his face flags only slightly when hers strikes right dead center.
Not as beautiful as that, Nicholas bends and kisses the back of her gloved hand.
Not as beautiful as you.
Katarine blushes and nods downfield toward the targets.
It will not be long until it is a true contest. You are becoming quite good. I cannot believe you have never practiced archery before.
Nicholas shrugs. He is nearly as handsome as Peter, even dressed strangely in a white mainland shirt and white shoes. His shoulders stretch the fabric when he takes position with his bow, and the underside of the gold hair against his collar is darkened with sweat.
I had no interest in it, he says, and lets another arrow fly.
It goes slightly wide.
Not as good. You must have distracted me.
My apologies.
Do not apologize. It is a welcome distraction.
Katarine reaches for another arrow. Her bow is newly fashioned, longer and harder to draw than her old one. But then, her arms have never been stronger. She knocks an arrow and fires it, then another, and another after that. The sound the arrows make when they hit is solid and satisfying. She wonders if they would sound the same catching Mirabella in the back.
I do not have to inspect the target to know that those were better shots than mine, says Nicholas,
as they set down their bows and move toward a small stone table beneath the shade of a tall, leafy alder tree.
I have been practicing archery since I was a small girl, though I must admit, I was never that skilled at it. A few months ago, those arrows might have been lost in the hedge.
On the table are two silver pitchers and two goblets. One is filled with Katarine's drink, straw-colored May wine, sweetened with honey and fresh berries, both poison and not. The other holds wine for Nicholas, dark red and cooled with water. Impossible to mistake for the other.
They tell me we are to depart soon, for Wolf Spring, Nicholas says, and I was just becoming accustomed to Greavesdrake Manor.
We will not be away long, and their midsummer ritual is said to be beautiful. Floating lamps flickering in the harbor. I always hoped I would see it. I just assumed I would have to wait until after I was crowned.
Nicholas takes a large gulp of wine. He looks at her slantways, and his eyes narrow with mischief.
I will long to return to your home in the capital, but I truly cannot wait to see you face to face with your sisters. I hope, he says and reaches for her gloved hand, that you will not leave me back when it happens.
Leave you back? She asks.
When you kill them. You will, of course.
He gestures toward the bows, toward the targets full of arrows.
And the servants have told me of your skill with a knife. Throwing them near to a target? I would very much like to see that.
Katarine's stomach tightens with pleasure, and a tingle rolls up and down her back as if touched by unseen fingers.
Would you indeed? She whispers. Perhaps you only think so.
You might feel different when you saw your future queen slide a knife into her pretty sister's breast.
Nicholas smiles. I come from a family of soldiers, Queen Katarine. I have seen much of that, and worse.
He takes another swallow of wine. It gathers at the corners of his mouth, bright red.
And I do not like to be back from the action.
Katarine's pulse quickens until her heart beats so fast it seems there is more than one in her chest. The look in his eyes brings blood to her cheeks. She has seen that look before, on Peter, right before he would pull her to him and take her to bed.
Natalia prefers that I poison from the safety of her bosom, she says. That is how the Aarons like to do it, quiet and refined.
Nothing pleases them more than pleasant dinner conversation that ends when someone's face falls dead to their plate. Nicholas lets his eyes move over her body.
There is charm in that, he says, but I would see your hands around their throats. A memory to take with me on the night of our marriage.
Giselle clears her throat. Ahem. Pardon me, my queen.
Giselle, Katarine says,
forgive me, we were so engrossed, that we did not hear you.
Giselle looks from Catherine to Nicholas and flushes slightly at their expressions.
Natalia sent for you, the maid says. She says you have a guest.
But I am already entertaining a guest.
She says you must come.
Catherine sighs. Please, you must go, Nicholas says. You don't want to keep the lady of the manor waiting. Catherine trudges up the stairs and down the hall to Natalia's study.
Natalia, she says, you sent for...
The rest of the words do not leave her mouth, because standing in the middle of the room, his back straight and eyes bright as a frightened rabbit's, is Peter.
I knew you would want to see him right away, Natalia says, smiling.
Do not be too hard on him, Catherine. I have already given him a stern lecture about leaving us for so long.
But of course he would want to, out of fear that she would send him to the cells beneath the Volroy, down so deep that he would never again see the sun. Out of terror that she would order Bertram Roman to batter his brains out against the stones at the long oval drive, or that she would do it herself.
No doubt you two would like to be alone, Natalia says.
No doubt, Catherine agrees.
The cages of dead birds and rodents were cleared out of Catherine's rooms when Nicholas arrived, but though her windows are kept open daily to combat the smell, it still lingers, and she hopes that Peter can detect it when he walks inside. The smell of death, of pain, and not of hers anymore. He enters the room ahead of her, so he does not see it when she takes up the short-bladed knife from one of her tables. He walks into her bedchamber unaware, so bold, as if he still has the right to be there. He taps the glass sides of Sweetheart's cage, and the snake lifts her pretty head.
I see Sweetheart as well, he says, and Catherine leaps upon him.
She drags him to the bed and twists her body around his, kneeling on the mattress to grip him from the back. One arm wraps around the crown of his head as the other drags the knife lightly across his throat.
Cat,
he says and gasps. This will be messy. She presses the knife harder into his skin. It will not take much. The edge is sharp and his vein is close. Giselle will have to fetch me a new coverlet. But it is true what Natalia says. You cannot poison a poisoner.
Cat, please.
Please what? She growls and squeezes his head tighter. His pulse races under her hands. But even as she wants to carve into his neck, she remembers what it was like, pressed against him like this. Her Peter, who she loved and who said he loved her. The scent of him, vanilla and ambergris, brings angry tears to the corners of her eyes.
How could you, Peter?
I am sorry, he says as the knife cuts into his throat.
I will give you sorry, she hisses.
I had to, he shouts quickly to stop her from cutting more.
Cat, please. I thought I had to.
Her grip on his head does not loosen.
Why? There was a plot. Natalia told me of it in the days before Beltane. The priestesses, they had devised a scheme to make Mirabella a white-handed queen. After your poor showing at the quickening, they planned to charge the stages. They planned to cut you into pieces and feed you into the fires.
But I did not have a poor showing, Catherine says, pressing the knife down again.
I did not know that. When you came to me that night, beside the Breccia domain, I thought that you were running from them, and I could not stand to see them touch you.
His hand strays up to her arm, and she steels herself. But he does not try to draw the knife from his neck. He only touches her softly.
I thought they were coming to kill you, and I could not let them. I would rather it be me.
So you pushed me down that hole? Catherine screeches through her teeth. Her whole body trembles with the rage of it. The shock and confusion when he shoved her.
It was a crime, what he did. It was betrayal. She should slash his throat and watch his blood pool around her legs. Instead, she draws back and throws the knife into the wall. Peter crumples forward, his hand pressed to the shallow wound on his neck.
You cut me, he says softly in disbelief.
I should have done worse. He turns to look at her, and she relishes the fear in his eyes.
I still might. I have not decided yet.
Clever, calculating Peter. He has dressed just so, in his dove-gray shirt and dark jacket, and he has kept his hair a little longer, the way she likes it best. Looking at him on her bed, she hates him, and is angry in so many ways. But he is still her Peter.
I would not blame you, but I am sorry, Cat.
He looks at her full, round shoulders.
You look different.
What did you expect? One does not get pushed into the Breccia domain and crawl out again unchanged.
I have wanted to come back to you for so long.
Of course you have. Back to the seat of Aaron Power.
Back to you.
His fingers twitch with wanting. He lifts his hand to caress her cheek. Catherine slaps it away.
You do not know what you have come back to, she says.
She grasps the sides of his head and kisses him forcefully, her lips hard enough to make it a punishment. She bites along his jaw. She licks the blood from the cut on his throat. He wraps his arms around her waist and pulls her to him.
Catherine, he says, and sighs. How I love you.
How indeed. She shoves him hard. How you must love me, Peter, she says, and leaves to return to Nicholas. But you will never have me again. Wolf Spring. The house is quiet. An odd thing for a naturalist house to be. Usually it is filled with barks and caws and someone in the kitchen, or Kate talking to the flock as they cluck and honk through the yard. Jules takes a deep breath and listens to the air move in and out. She sips a hot cup of willow bark tea and strokes Camden's head where it rests on her leg. She and the cat have been even closer than usual since Jules's Legion curse became known. They cling to each other, unsure what it might mean for their bond. The thought that one day she could wake and find that Camden is not a part of her anymore, it is more terrifying than anything she could do with the war gift. Madrigal walks in, back from the market with her arms full of baskets, breaking the peace. "Will you help me?" she asks. I'm making chowder with fresh cream and biscuits with that soft white cheese that you like. What's the occasion? Jules asks, suspiciously. She takes the basket of clams and dumps them into the sink to wash. No occasion. Madrigal sets the rest of her shopping on the countertop. But when it's ready, you could float the bowls onto the table for us. Jules scowls. That isn't how it works. How do you know? Madrigal asks. The war gift has been weak for so long that nobody knows how it works. That is true enough. Everything Jules has ever heard about the war gift has been the stuff of long-ago legends. Of the recent, there are only rumors. Folk in Bastion City who have uncanny accuracy with knives and bows. Near-impossible shots made so clean that it is almost as if the weapon were pulled on a string. But it is not pull, so much as push. Jules has worked at it, alone and mostly in secret, aghast and amazed at what she is able to do. At the sink, Madrigal begins scrubbing clams, nearly managing to look like she has done it before. She wipes her forehead. Sallow circles mar the undersides of her eyes, and she is still breathless from the walk. Are you all right? Jules asks.
I'm fine. How are you?
Is that willow bark tea? Is your leg paining you?
Madrigal? What's going on?
Nothing, she says.
Only that...
She pauses and heaps washed clams into a pot.
Only that I'm pregnant.
She twists at the waist and flashes a fast smile, then looks back down at her hands.
Matthew and I are going to have a baby.
Arya flies nervously onto the table. Her wing feathers shift in the quiet.
You? Jules says.
And Aunt Kara's Matthew are going to have a baby?
Don't call him that. He is not her Matthew.
That's how we all think of him. That's how we'll always think of him.
Honestly, Jules?
Madrigal says, her tone slightly disgusted. After what happened between Joseph and Queen Mirabella, I thought you'd have grown up a little.
Jules's temper rises, and on the countertop, Madrigal's knife begins to rattle, as if of its own accord.
Don't, Jules. Madrigal backs away.
Don't do that.
The knife stops.
I'm not, Jules says quickly. I mean, I didn't mean to.
Your war gift is strong. You should let me unbind it.
Grandma Kate says the binding might be all that's keeping me sane.
Or all that's holding you back.
Jules looks at the knife. She could make it move, make it fly, make it cut. Nothing about her naturalist gift has ever felt so wicked or out of control.
Madrigal picks up the knife, and Jules breathes easier with it safe in her hand.
I suppose this means you're not happy about the baby.
But you can't hate him, Jules, just to spite me.
You won't, will you?
No, Jules says darkly. I will be a good sister.
Madrigal looks at her. Then she rolls potatoes onto the counter and starts to chop them.
I thought I would be so happy, she mutters. I thought this baby would make me so happy.
Pity for you, then, says Jules. Nothing is ever as good as you want it to be. A second crow, larger than Arya, flies into the kitchen and lands on the table with a letter in her beak. It is Eva, Grandma Kate's familiar, and the letter bears the seal of the Black Council. Kate comes in behind her and sees the scowl on Jules's face.
I take it that you've told her about the baby.
Why does everyone in this family know things before I do? Jules asks.
Never mind that, Jules. You'll get over it.
Jules nods toward Eva's letter.
What does it say?
That Wolf Spring is about to be crowded. It seems that both of the other queens and their households are coming for midsummer. Where has Arsinoe gotten off to?
The woods, I think. With Braddock?
You'd better go, then, and tell her.
Jules gets up from the table and she and Camden head outside. They hurry down the path to the road, stretching the muscles in their bad legs. They meet Joseph as they reach the hilltop fork.
What's got you in such a hurry?
He asks, as she slips her hand into his and tugs him along.
News for Arsinoe. I'm glad you're here. It saves us a trip.
Oh, no, Arsinoe says when Jules and Joseph come into the meadow. What news is there now?
She had been watching Braddock pluck blackberries off a vine, his flapping lips nearly as good as fingers.
Mirabella and Catarine are coming here, Jules says, for midsummer, and they're each bringing an army of supporters besides.
The letter from the council just arrived.
Arsinoe's shoulders slump.
The other queens, here. Wolf Spring will be flooded with strangers.
A lot of good it did, my trying to keep Mirabella out of my city.
I don't like it, Jules growls. And at her side, Camden snarls.
We won't be able to guard you. It'll be chaos.
It won't be easy, Joseph agrees.
But at least we'll be here, at home, where we know how things lie.
Midsummer is in less than a week, Arsinoe says. And there was no letter of warning from Billy. What good is having a spy in Rolanth if he can't even tell us about this?
Rolanth might not have gotten more notice than we did, says Jules. But that is unlikely.
Even if it was an errand plot, the temple would have needed to agree.
Arsinoe sighs.
Naturalists. We are always the last to know.
After you're crowned, there will be naturalists on the council, Joseph says. Wolfspring will finally have a say again in how Fenburn is run.
Arsinoe and Jules trade glances. Joseph, the look says, ever the optimist.
Has Billy written? He asks. Is he well? Is he safe?
He's written twice. He promised to write daily. Arsinoe crosses her arms. Two letters, and both were formal and stilted, containing none of the awful personality that she misses so much. She looks at her friends standing in the meadow, where they have stood so many times before. The summer sun casts their shadows onto the ground, and those shadows seem like the ghosts of their childhood, forever running through these trees.
Our happy ending, she says quietly.
Arsinoe, says Jules, you have to do something. You know why they're coming.
Not to talk.
Foolish to have thought that talking would stop Mirabella from searing blisters up and down her back. Arsinoe watches Braddock foraging in the bushes. She does not want to put him in danger, or Jules or Joseph, but they are all she has. Only her friends and her low magic.
Greavesdrake Manor. Katarine holds Sweetheart carefully as she extracts the snake's venom, pressing the glands. The yellow poison runs down the sides of the glass jar. There is not very much. Sweetheart is a small snake, and even in a small jar, her venom barely coats the bottom. Nicholas leans across her bed, watching, enrapt.
How strange, he whispers, that so little of a thing can cause such great harm.
Katarine pries the snake free with a gentle motion and places her back into her cage. Sweetheart writhes crankily and bites at the glass, wriggling as she tries to inject venom that is no longer there. Nicholas recoils. Katarine giggles. She screws a lid onto the jar.
What will you use it for?
He asks. Perhaps nothing. She tips it back and forth and watches the poison run. I just wanted a bit of her with me, since I must leave her behind. Now let us go. She tugs him playfully off the bed and he kisses her gloved fingers. Downstairs, Natalia arches an eyebrow, already waiting at the door. But she does not scold. Indeed, she smiles toothlessly at the sight of their linked hands. Outside, a dark caravan packed full of errands and poisons stretches down the long horseshoe drive.
I cannot wait to see the faces on the bumpkins of Wolf Spring when we arrive, Katarine says.
Their bottom teeth will scrape the dirt.
The household servants line up to bid them farewell, and as she passes her maid Giselle, Katarine reaches out and squeezes her shoulder. Giselle jerks back. Her eyes fall to the stone steps.
She is afraid of me, Katarine realizes, and looks down the row.
They are all afraid of her. Even Edmund, Natalia's steadfast butler. Katarine smiles at Giselle and kisses her cheek, as if she had not noticed. She turns away when she hears horse hooves clip-clopping in her direction. She will not ride in a coach, like the others. Peter rides up on a tall black mare and leads two saddle horses behind him, Katarine's favorite, Half Moon, and the blood bay Nicholas brought from the mainland.
This will be a good opportunity to let people see you, Natalia says.
To see how well and healthy you are, Genevieve adds, and stops talking when Natalia shoots her a look.
The island will see her as she passes, a live queen, not the decaying animated corpse the rumors would have them believe.
Whatever the reason, I am glad to ride outside, she says.
Loaded as they are, the caravan will move at a snail's pace, and still slower, when navigating the steep and unkempt roads in the hills. Peter starts to dismount, to help Katarine into the saddle.
Don't trouble yourself, Renard, Nicholas says, using Peter's non-Aran name on purpose, just to irritate him.
I will assist my queen.
She is not your queen yet, Peter mutters, and Catherine grins at him before Nicholas boosts her on to Half Moon.
Careful, Peter, she whispers, after Nicholas has gone to mount his own horse, or Natalia and Genevieve will send you away.
She takes up her reins, but Peter holds fast to Half Moon's bridle.
They may, but I will not go, he says. I will be here until the day you tell me to leave.
Catherine's pulse quickens. The look Peter gives to Nicholas is so dark that she wonders whether it is a good idea that they both remain at Greavesdrake. If their rivalry goes much further, she will enter the drawing room one day and find Nicholas poisoned or Peter slumped across the sofa with a knife in his back.
May we ride ahead?
Nicholas asks, bringing his horse up beside hers.
We can circle back around to the carriages if we go too far, unless your horse will tire.
Impossible. Catherine strokes Half Moon's long, sleek neck. Half Moon can run for days and never tire. He is the finest horse on the whole island. They trot together down the drive, ahead of the caravan, but behind the guard and the scouts. The day is hot, but with a strong, cool breeze. A true midsummer day. Perhaps a good omen?
What is that? There.
Nicholas gestures toward the end of the drive. A cluster of women in white and black robes, priestesses from Indrid Down Temple, have gathered to give her a blessing. As they ride closer, Catherine notes that head priestess Cora is not among them.
So many coaches, says one of the priestesses, whose name she does not remember.
Wolf Spring will overflow. Indeed, Catherine says. When I leave, they may be poorer by one queen, but much richer in money from the capital.
Have you come to give the goddess's blessing?
We have. Tonight we go into the hills to pray and burn oleander. Half Moon starts to fidget, and Catherine takes up an inch of his rein. Everyone knows that the temple supports Mirabella, she says. But you are priestesses of Indrid Down, in service to poisoners since you came.
All queens are sacred, the priestess responds.
Catherine's jaw tenses. She glances at Nicholas, who moves his horse back.
I know you do not like me, Catherine whispers. I know you sense that I am wrong, even if you will not say so.
All queens are sacred, the priestess says again, in her infuriating, even voice. Catherine would like to ride the white robes into the dirt, grind them into the mud until they are stained dark red and brown. But the caravan approaches in hoofbeats and jangling harnesses, trunks and wheels rattling. So instead, she smiles a smile of bared teeth.
Yes, she says. All queens are sacred. Even those you threw into a pit.
Roland. A woman and her husband kneel before the temple over an offering of dyed and scented water. The water is a dark, stormy blue, calm inside a beautiful mosaic bowl of white and silver glass.
Blessings upon you, Queen Mirabella, the woman murmurs.
And Mirabella extends her hand over her bent head. She recognizes them from the central district. They are merchants who deal in silks and precious stones, and she has seen the woman through her carriage window as they passed, shouting orders to workers restoring the vaulted theater. Not many from Roland will accompany her to Wolf Spring. Since it was announced that the Reaping Moon would be held here in a few months' time, there is simply too much to do.
Thank you for your offering, Elizabeth says, and picks up the bowl to be brought inside.
Bree takes Mirabella by the arm. Once inside, Mirabella takes a deep breath. The open air smells of temple roses in full bloom, and beneath that, the salt of the sea and the cold, earthy essence of her beloved basalt cliffs. Today they depart for the long road to Wolf Spring. Wagons have been loaded with supplies, and at Westwood House, coaches stand ready with a portion of her wardrobe folded away in trunks.
You seem so sad, Bree says, as they walk around the southern dome. Are you not even a little bit excited?
Mirabella pauses before Queen Shannon's mural, storms and lightning in blue and gold paint. The Weather Queen seems to be gazing down upon her.
I should not be excited, she says. I should be ready.
No decree from the Black Council is to be trusted, so long as the Errands control it.
Bree rolls her eyes.
Now you sound like Luca. This is a good thing, do you not see? You will kill Katarine and Arsinoe both, and then we will have nothing but feasting and suitors until your crowning at Beltane.
Everyone in Roland seems to agree, indoctrinated by Luca all these years to believe Mirabella's legend.
It will be hard to protect you in Wolfspring, Elizabeth says. The people are wild, and with the temple obligated to be neutral, Ro will not be able to help.
Her gift will keep her safe, Bree says confidently, and so will we. That is what foster guardians are for.
She pats Mirabella's hand, but in truth, they have always relied on the priestesses for their security. The Westwoods have had nearly no practice guarding her, at all.
Are you frightened, Mira? Elizabeth asks. My senses are uneasy, she replies. I do not like leaving Roland, and that it was not our idea.
And she cannot stop thinking of what Billy told her.
That Arsinoe had not sent the bear, and she did not fight back in the Ashburn Woods, or use the bear then to harm her.
She looks into Elizabeth's wide, dark eyes.
I am only afraid of what I must do.
Elizabeth slips her arm around the queen.
It will be all right, she says,
and Pepper the woodpecker flits from his hiding place in her hood to nibble on Mirabella's earlobe.
Pepper ought to be in a tree, Bree whispers. It is risky having him with you in the temple, close to so many watchful eyes.
I know.
Elizabeth rolls her shoulder and Pepper disappears back into her robes.
But it's hard to get him to leave me when he knows I'm nervous or upset. So do not be nervous or upset. Mira will not fail us.
As they pass by an open storeroom door, they see Billy, bent over a barrel. Harriet the chicken sees them and clucks. Billy straightens and knocks dust and straw out of his hair.
Oh-ho, you've caught me.
What are you doing? Mirabella asks.
I'm setting aside things to bring with us to Wolf Spring. I heard there were jarred tomatoes and blackberries. For your favorite of my dishes, warmed jarred tomatoes on toast.
I thought you would be better at cooking by now, Bree scolds. Mira has grown so thin. Half of her dresses had to be sent to the tailor.
Why don't you teach me then, Bree?
He asks.
If you are any better at it, I'll eat my hat.
Elizabeth giggles.
Bree can barely slice bread for a sandwich. Oh, who needs to slice bread anyway?
Bree steps into the storage room to help Billy search the crates.
What happened to buying from town? She asks,
her voice strained as they lift a crate lid.
My mother gave you money, and the priestesses would inspect whatever you bought.
Yes, well, that money may have found its way into a very fine restaurant on Dale Street, and into a few of the pubs off the marketplace.
Billy Chatworth, Mirabella exclaims. You have been feasting, and I have been eating jarred tomatoes on toast.
Billy grins.
I tried going into the market, but I didn't care for the merchants there. They spat at Harriet like she was a familiar.
Mirabella's smile fades. The resentment between the people will lessen in time. Luca says the island will be united under her once the crown is settled.
Perhaps I ought to go along, Bree starts,
and then Elizabeth screams. She shakes her head and covers her mouth with her hand. Pepper flies from her hood and flaps in noisy circles around the storeroom, his little body striking the walls in panic. Elizabeth points with the stump of her wrist.
The priestess, dead behind the stack of barrels, has not been dead long.
Her cheeks are still pink, and gold curls fall softly across her forehead. From her neck up, she could be sleeping. But below it is a horror of swollen blood vessels so inflamed that they stand out on her chest like cracks in a vase. The bodice of the poisoned dress is tight and touches so much of her skin. Blue fabric streaked now with blood, and the girl's fingernails full of her own flesh from trying to claw her way out of it.
There now, Billy says, gathering Elizabeth close and trying to quiet her. Mirabella, stay back.
Footsteps echo down the corridor. Priestess is coming to investigate the screams.
Get Pepper back into your robes, Bree hisses.
But the poor bird is panicked. Thinking fast, Mirabella stumbles into the doorway to divert attention, so Elizabeth can calm down and collect him.
What is it?
The first of the priestesses demands. She looks Mirabella over, head to toe, and the others push into the storeroom. When they see the fallen girl, a few of them moan miserably. The girl was one of them. One of theirs.
Luca pauses briefly in her pacing to touch Mirabella's hair. Mirabella is on the sofa in Luca's rooms, wedged snugly between Bree and Elizabeth and an embroidered pillow. The door opens, but it is only an initiate carrying a tray of tea and cookies, which Billy dutifully tastes, even though it will all go untouched.
I do not want you to do that anymore, Mirabella says.
It's what I'm here for, he says gently.
I knew the risks, as did my father when he sent me.
You were here to make a point, Luca corrects him, and so your father could garner favor with us. Personally, I think he is mad to put you in this poisoner's path, even with my priestesses tasting before you.
No one else must do this, Mirabella says. No tasters, no more.
The dead girl's face floats in her mind, warring with another image locked inside her. Little Catarine, sweet and smiling. The door opens again. This time it is Ro. She has taken down her hood and red hair blazes past her shoulders.
Who was it? Luca asks.
The novice, Rebecca.
Luca presses her hands to her face. Mirabella did not know her, except for seeing her pass by in the temple.
She was ambitious, Luca explains, sitting down finally in one of her overstuffed chairs. She must have been testing the dress.
Alone, Ro asks. And by putting it on?
She was a good priestess, devoted, from a farm in Waring. I will write to her family and send blessing. We will place the ashes in an urn after she is burned, in case her mother wishes her remains be returned.
Mirabella winces. It is all so fast, so businesslike.
Did she suffer? Mirabella asks. I do not care if you think it a weak question, Ro. I want you to answer.
Ro's jaw unclenches.
I suppose I do not know, my queen. From the skin raked under her fingernails, I would say yes. But the poisoning was fast. No one heard her cry out, and she did not have time to leave the storeroom for help.
Do we know what it was? Asks Luca.
Something absorbed through contact with the skin.
The wounds are localized near the bodice, where the dress fit the tightest.
We will examine it before it is destroyed, to look for hidden pins or razors.
Catarine, Mirabella whispers. You are so terrible now.
Rebecca should never have put on that dress, Ro says.
But she would not have known, Bree protests. Do you not see? That dress was blue. It was not sent for the queen. It was sent for one of us.
She glares up at Ro.
Why would she do that?
She is clever, this poisoner. If she cannot get to you directly, she will goad you into action by killing those in your household.
She is not clever.
Elizabeth's voice is low as she wipes at her eyes with the back of her hand. Mirabella puts her arms around her.
She is cruel.
Wolf Spring.
In the clearing, beneath the bent-over tree, Arsinoe lets Madrigal take fresh blood from her arm. Overhead, thin green leaves rustle on the ancient branches.